Hi. Boy, it's been a long time. I think the last time I spoke here was in 2017. And at that time, I told you all the NDEs, including my own. But tonight, I was asked to kind of do it in a little bit different format. And so we'll get into what I'm going to do. It's going to be a little bit different, okay? So I am a nurse practitioner. I've worked in critical care, emergency room, Lifelight for 12 years. DMAT teams going into some of the most unforgiving, catastrophic disasters you've ever seen. And I've been in cardiology and all since 1980. So as you know, I'm pretty moldy, pretty crusty. Been there, done that for a very long time. Given that, I have been in this situation many, many, many times, where my patients have coded, and I have been actively involved in their resuscitations and have been able to talk to them post their cardiac arrest. But we're not going to get into what they told me about their near-death experiences this time. Maybe I can talk another time, but tonight we're going to talk about all the divine intervention that happened to me personally while I was resuscitating those patients, because most of the time you don't get to hear that part. That's not something that nurses or doctors will ever really discuss with you. So that's what we're going to discuss tonight. Okay. All right. So to start with, 2 months ago, I was taking care of a 96-year-old little Spanish lady, sweet, sweet little lady, horrible heart failure. And I was an advanced heart failure specialist taking care of these really, really sick patients. All through our office visit, she kept looking over my right shoulder and she'd smile. And she just keep looking over there and smiling and nodding her head. I thought, what's going on? What is she doing? But when we were done, she came up to me and took my little hand and patted me. And she said to me, honey, you realize that right behind you is the biggest, most beautiful angel I've ever seen in my entire life. I says, no, I didn't know that. And she says, honey, that angel's been with you your entire career. And he whispers in your ear what you should do about your patient and how to take care of them. And he will be there until you retire. That's been his mission, is to help you with your patients. So remember, he's always there whispering. Boy, that had a lot of clicking, because some of the stories I'm going to tell you tonight, you'll hear the active involvement of that guardian medical angel that I've had whispering in my ear the whole career. Okay, we have about 30 minutes, so hopefully we can get through these. But people like to hear how I first got started knowing about near-death experiences. So I'm going to tell you my very, very first experience with somebody who had an NDE. I was young, naive, cocky, arrogant. I was the charge nurse in the CCU and I was night shift. Got it? Yeah. Okay. So I walked in, and one of the patients in the curtained-in area was a 50-year-old woman who had had a great big heart attack. And this is before the days of stents, okay? You had a heart attack, you finished your heart attack. It's just the way it was. She had had a cardiac arrest, and she was now had been with us for 3 days in the unit. And she was slated to move to the floor the next morning. So I sat down in front of the big bank of cardiac monitors, kicked my feet up, and got ready to watch the monitors. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, right? God help me to stay awake. Please, no one code on me tonight. So I see this woman doing this. You know what goes through my cocky little arrogant brain was, oh, not another crazy one. So I'm a good nurse. I got up, I walked over to her, and she pull that drape and sit down. I thought, wow, we really do have a crazy one on our hands. So I pulled the drape and I sat down. I want to get this right because she was very specific. She said, now, don't be shocked. I need to tell you something. I was shown you, and I need to tell you exactly what happened to me. I don't know why I have to tell you, but I do. So don't say anything. Don't open your mouth. Just listen. Okay. I'm still thinking she's a little crazy. Okay. So she says to me, this is why I came back after my heart attack, so I can tell you this experience. Once I've delivered this message, I get to go home. So hush, I'm going to tell you because I'm going home. Okay. She then got after me and said, I have been waiting 3 days for you to walk in this unit. What took you so long? Well, excuse me for having a day off. Oops. But she really got after me for waiting 3 days because she wanted to go home and she didn't want to have to wait. Well, as you can imagine by now, you know, the old goosebumps and hairs going off the back of your neck and you're just going, oh no. So here's what she proceeded to tell me. She left her body. She watched the paramedics working on her. She was able to tell me completely, totally, accurately what the paramedics did to resuscitate her. She said all the pain from the MI was gone. She felt pretty darn good. But she grew really bored watching her cardiac arrest resuscitation by the paramedics. So she traversed up a tunnel. She stated that she'd had a similar experience several years before. So she knew what to do when she got to the tunnel. And she zipped right up that tunnel. No big deal. I did go and pull her medical records. And she had had an MI with a cardiac arrest 2 years previously. So she was accurate in that, okay? All right. She told me the tunnel was very misty. It's white, but it's very warm and it wasn't scary at all. At the end of the tunnel was a really bright light. And she knew that she was supposed to go into that bright light. So off she went. Once she entered the light, she was in a garden with a marble stone bench. Many of her deceased family members were there waiting for her and were very, very happy to see her. She stated that she needed to describe to me the feelings that she had there in the garden with her family. So she then proceeded to tell me about the intense feelings of peace, of love, of happiness that she was there. She then walked down the path in the garden and was met by a man she described as Jesus. And she described to me her feelings of being embraced by Jesus and what it felt like. And by now I had tears, as you can imagine, coming down this little cocky, arrogant nurse's face. He asked her one little question, and I have found out over the 45 years I've been doing this now, this is normally the question people are asked. How have you loved your fellow man? Her whole life rolled before her again, because this is the second time she's done it. She's able to see and comprehend all of her actions, thoughts, feelings, not only of herself, but of the people she was interacting with. After this life review, Christ took her back to her family, her little family reunion. But one of her family members told her she had to go back. It wasn't her time yet. At this point, Jesus showed her an ICU unit. She was shown me working on patients. She was able to see my face, my makeup, my eye color, my actions, my tone of voice, my haircut. She could even smell my perfume. She knew everything about me. She was then told that she would have to wait for me to walk in the unit and she was to tell me of her experience. As soon as she was done, she could come home. That was her mission. Tell me. She died 3 days later. She went home. That was my first experience, and that's what led me to begin my research into what on earth was she talking about. Okay. So I want to review really quickly with you, and some of this will be new to some of you, and some of you, this will be, duh, I got it. I already know that. Okay. So bear with me. So what types of things do patients or your loved ones, or your neighbors, or your friends, or whoever you're talking about in your death experience, what are some of the things they might describe to you? First one is usually a peace, a euphoria, a feeling of intense love, peace, well-being, something of that nature, okay? And I can attest to that myself. The next is they're obviously out of their body. They're usually watching their code like I did, or they're looking at something outside of the body and they know they're out of their body. Got it? Okay. Some will describe a tunnel, some won't. Not everybody has a tunnel experience in their NDE. Okay. All right. Light. Being surrounded by the most intense light you've ever seen, which was how I had mine. And there's nothing on this earth that can even come close to describing that white, brilliant, loving light that you experience. Sounds, singing, music, humming, a vibration, some sort of, mine was humming vibrations, a vibrational humming type thing. Others are the singing, some sort of a sound that they might hear. They might describe being somewhere else. I was in a garden. I was up in the city of heaven. I went and visited my kids in the house. I went to all these different hospital rooms. They go somewhere, okay? They travel. They encounter deceased people, their family, ancient relatives, is usually, but friends. But they have discussions with a deceased person. A lot of them will have a life review. Not everybody has a life review. Okay? I did not have a life review. A lot of people do. Okay? All right. Receive knowledge. They're just infused with knowledge. Like they come back like knowing everything. I think of Sheldon Cooper. They just know everything of everything. Okay? All right. Then usually they're given a decision period. Do you want to go back or not? Now, some people are not given a decision. They're forced back. And we're going to get into those subgroup of people. But I was given a choice. Most people are given a choice. Do you want to go back or not? Okay. And they have to make that decision. So let's talk about some of my patients. And I'm going to talk to you, like I said, about the divine intervention that happened to me during these resuscitations. I have previously spoken about these children's near-death experiences that were quite extensive, and I'm not going to do that tonight, okay? So first one we're going to talk about is Bill. Some of you might know Bill. But Bill was hit by a train. So I went to pick up Bill. He had been hit by a train in his pickup truck. He'd gotten stuck on the tracks, and he was just, frankly, super critically injured. And it was a fixed wing or an airplane flight. He was very unstable. And my paramedic and I were a little bit worried about having to fly him back because he was so critical. So we arrived at that small hospital that he was at. And yep, he was bad. He was intubated. He was on a ventilator. He had unstable vital signs. He was not a fun flight in an airplane for over an hour. Okay, let me just put it that way. So we began to stabilize him in that little tiny hospital and continued throughout the entire fixed wing flight. Now, as I was doing this, I continued to constantly have thoughts pop into my head. Thoughts, just random weird thoughts, such as, have you tried dopamine recently? How about trying to increase the pressure on that ventilator? How about use this drug for sedation? Why don't you start that antibiotic? How about you change the NG tube out for an oral gastric tube and get that down fairly quick? Why don't you change the pressure on that ventilator? So for the whole flight, I kept having these random thoughts hitting in my head. Now I know who was telling me those thoughts in my ear, okay? But at the time, I just didn't get it, okay? But every thought that popped into my head, as I quickly acted on it, it helped stabilize Bill a little bit more and a little bit more, so that the point when I got to the trauma center, he was stable. Imagine that, he was stable. Now I thank my medical guardian angel for helping me on that flight, because that was a scary flight. So let's talk about Leonard. Y'all know where MADCOR is? West Salt Lake. West? Okay. MADCOR is a ginormous chemical plant. Okay. So one really cold, windy, and may I stress windy flight. It was early in my career, and being in a little helicopter in a windy, stormy night is not the funnest flight. So, okay. I had been a critical care nurse for about 12 years at this point, but I was a fresh green bean flight nurse. Okay. About 2 o'clock in the morning, we're called to Mag Corps to go pick up an explosion victim. All the way there, my very experienced and seasoned paramedic kept telling me, it's never as bad as they say. Relax. You got this. So we landed at the plant's front parking lot and we met the ambulance there. And I hit this door and my paramedic hit this door. And we opened the back doors of the ambulance and we just stood there staring. And I'll never forget this. He looks down at me and says, I take that all back. It's worse. They had taken buckets of ice water and saturated this poor patient. There was about 2 inches of ice water in the back of that ambulance. This poor Leonard, his arms were mummified up like this. They were just mummified, okay? He had a hole right here for his mouth. His nose is kind of melted off. His eyes were melted off. He was gray, green in color. And there wasn't really a point that I could see that wasn't burned. I started to panic. Like, I'm getting really tachycardic and I'm hyperventilating. I'm looking at my paramedic like, I can't do this. And he said, you got this, you've got it. Okay, right, I got it. So Leonard was conscious. Leonard was completely conscious. So I asked him if he knew what happened and he mumbled because, you know, his tongue was working and he could mumble, but it was like this. So he said, yeah, he knew what had happened. Now, I talked and talked and talked with him. I did a quick assessment and I asked him if there was anything he wanted me to tell his wife. And he said, yes, tell her I love her very much. I said, okay. And then I gently discussed with him that he was going to die that night. And there was nothing I was going to be able to do to save his life. And he says, I know, do your best, but I know I'm going to die. I said, okay. So my paramedic took his airway, because it was either tube here or cut here, right? So he's set up for both. My job was to get an IV in. He's mummified. He's mummified. There is nowhere to put an IV in this guy. The only place that wasn't burned was a palm-sized area on his left groin. That's it. Well, your groin happens to have some really deep blood vessels. You put central lines in an emergency. Okay, so that's what I was going to have to do. Now, mind you, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. The wind's rocking the back of the ambulance. I'm kneeling in 2 to 3 inches of ice water. And I have a flashlight wedged in my teeth to shine light on what I'm doing. Okay, that's the scenario. So I got my central line stuff out. The needle's 6 inches, guys. Okay. And I've got to go in that groin. And in normal good circumstances, this procedure takes about 30 minutes or more. Okay. I'm in trouble, obviously, aren't I? So I took that needle and I went to go in. And all of a sudden, I felt hands grip my hands. Somebody held my hands. And I thought, whoa, okay, you do your thing. I didn't have to do anything. They stuck the needle in at the right angle and the right depth, and I hit that vein within about 5 seconds. It's unheard of. It just doesn't happen, okay? Well, once I'm in, I'm able to do all the wires and everything, and I had that central line in less than 5 minutes. Unheard of. But it was only because I had somebody from the other world holding my hand in a very tight grip, putting that needle into where it needed to be. Okay. Leonard did survive. He did survive. And we had many a great talks until he passed away from pneumonia about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I guess now. But he was a phenomenal man. All right, let's talk about Kyle. Kyle's 16, He's a typical 16-year-old. He and four of his friends decided to ditch school, Smithfield High School. They wanted to go to Bear Lake. They wanted to swim. They didn't want to sit in math class. Are you kidding me? So they hopped in their car and they took off. And they spent the day playing at Bear Lake. They had a great time. And now it's time to get home because they had to get back to the high school so that nobody would know they ditched class. So there was a time limit, right? Okay. So Kyle's in the back passenger seat and 16-year-old friend. I don't know if anybody had gone from Bear Lake up that mountain road to get through Logan. I mean, his hairpin turns. You know the road I'm talking about? Okay. So, excuse me, this 16-year-old was obviously going way too fast. And they were giggling and not paying attention. And he went over into the opposite lane of traffic on one of those hairpin turns. Okay. He hit a one-ton pickup carrying six horses head on. For unknown reasons, because that there was nothing left of the car, Kyle was the worst injured. He didn't have a seatbelt on, so I'm sure he bounced around. I call it the Princess Diana effect. He ripped up his internals really bad. So he was able to actually get out of the car and stumble to the side of the road where he collapsed. So we brought the helicopter in and landed on the road. Of course, nobody's getting by this mess at all anyway. All right. So I walked over to where Kyle was lying in the dirt. He's confused. He's combative. He's hypotensive. He's tachycardic. And he's telling me he just can't breathe. And he's fighting me. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. So because I've been asked this a lot, and I don't know if there's medical in here, but I'll tell you what his injuries ended up being. He had a ruptured diaphragm and he had small and large intestine completely crammed up into his chest cavity, which had collapsed both his lungs. He had a ruptured colon, a right pneumo, left pneumothorax, broken and crushed thoracic spine, mesenteric artery tears, fractured pelvis in multiple places, and obviously a head injury. So obviously he was a mess. He was a real mess. So I wanted to put the breathing tube down, intubate Kyle right there on the roadside. I mean, we were in trouble. But at the time, I had to call the trauma center and get permission to intubate. This practice was stopped after this flight, just saying, okay? So there was a very arrogant ER resident, not even the attending, the resident, who forbade me from intubating this patient. He wanted to assess the patient himself to see if it was really warranted. So, needless to say, I was really mad. I mean, you could only imagine I was really mad. We loaded Kyle into the helicopter and we took off like a bat out of you know where, the backside of the Wasatch to get to the trauma center. Well, as soon as we got to altitude, of course, Kyle stopped breathing. It's called a respiratory arrest, right? So, we started bagging him and I'm screaming at him because you know the rotor noise is really loud, right? So I'm screaming at him, damn it, Kyle, don't you leave me, breathe. Now to intubate somebody, you just stand at the head of their bed, right? It's head of the bed, you intubate. Well, in the helicopter, I'm actually sitting to the side by his hips and here's Kyle's head. And I have to intubate him backwards and sideways. Okay, not the best of situations in a full respiratory arrest. And if I'm not fast about this, he's going to cardiac arrest on top of it. So this intubation was truly miraculous because from this angle, I nailed it on the first try. And I wasn't the one pulling the laryngoscope up. Somebody else was doing that for me. I could feel their hands right here, pulling the laryngoscope up as I digitally felt down in and blindly put the tube down into Kyle. I had help doing that. That wasn't me. That was that wonderful guardian angel I've recently found out about. Okay. He did all that to get it done. Throughout all of this, and including with Leonard, when I felt that hand touch me and grip my hands, you have this most profound wave of calm wash over you. And I'm no longer doing this or okay. No, I got totally calm and it happened again and again and again. It happened with Kyle. Just a wave of calmness. Just totally wash over you. Okay, we have time for just a little bit more. So Brad, some of you have heard me talk about Brad. He was eight. He was six when I took care of him, but eight. He lived in rural Wyoming, and I mean really rural. He was playing in his backyard, and he was really bored. So he thought he'd go siphon some of that tractor gas out and put it in a soda can and flick his dick and kick that soda can, watch it flaming through the air. Some of you heard me talk about this kid. Well, that's what he did. And as soon as he kicked that flaming can, he became the Human Torch. So he ran into the house of all flames, and his mom was able to roll him and, you know, get him out, get the flames out. And she scooped him up and threw him in the car. And it's 45 minutes into the closest GP doctor's office. So that's what he did. That's what they did. Poor doc was 70 years old, a little GP. Due to thunderstorms in the area, we could not fly into this little town. So the doctor took off in an ambulance. We took off in the airplane. We were going to rendezvous. So that's what we did. Okay, we rendezvoused. So when they got to this little one-room emergency room is where I set up shop, Brad comes in the door, and he's sitting straight up, tripoding on the stretcher. His deer in the headlight looked like, oh my gosh, but he was sucking air for all he's worth, and he couldn't speak because he was sucking air. His cardiac monitor had a heartbeat of 220 beats a minute. And that cute little GP said, you know, I put a Foley in and I gave him IV Lasix, but I can't get him to pee anything. He was a mess. So he had no peripheral pulses, no obtainable blood pressure, heart rate of 220, and he was sucking air. Obviously, we were in trouble, okay? I looked at my paramedic, and truly, honestly, no words were necessary. We both knew we were going to lose a child this night. There would be no way we were going to save this kid. So I knew that the minute I put him to sleep to put that breathing tube in, he was going to cardiac arrest. I just knew it. Absolutely 100% knew it. And I knew I would not be able to get him back. So what I did is I had to go talk to his mom. I explained that he most likely was going to die and that was going to be nothing I could do. And he would never leave this little hospital. To go in and say goodbye to him while he was still awake, because then I was going to put him to sleep and he probably wouldn't make it. So that's what she did. She went and said goodbye to her sweet little boy. He had 70% third degree burns, and everywhere else on his body was first or second degree burns. There was nowhere on this poor child's body that wasn't burned. So the first thing I had to do was again place a deep central line in the groin on this kid. Now, in a kid, it takes even longer than in an adult because you're working with smaller blood vessels. So normally it's 30 to 45, maybe even 60 minutes to get a line in. I didn't have that kind of time. He was going to be dead by then. Okay. I had to move fast. So I went to place this line in. And again, I felt that hand just grip mine, put the needle in at the right angle, the right depth, the right direction. And I nailed it. It was right into that vein that I needed to be in. And I got that line in about 5-6 minutes. Perfect. It was beautiful. Then I got an arterial line in on the other side. Same thing happened. Same thing. So it was just phenomenal. That wave of my hand stopped shaking. It was calm. I could do this. So we coded little Bradley for the next 2 hours. We intubated him, placed the central line, placed the arterial line, and he needed full body escharotomies to open up so blood could flow. I mean, he was a mess. But with divine help, we were able to actually get him to stop coding long enough to get him in the airplane and get him back to the burn center at the U. Brad did survive. I still talk to him. He's 35 now. We talk to him all the time. He's doing fabulous. And he had an extremely extensive near-death experience that maybe sometime we can go over on another experience. Okay, we have one last one, and then we'll see how much time we have left after that. So Tom, I haven't talked about Tom, I don't think, in this group. Tom was 10. So we're called down to Central Utah to help with the snowmobile accident. Several families are out snowmobiling, having a great time. You know how you do. So Tom was 10. He's sitting in front of his dad on the snowmobile. His dad's behind. And they were going super, super fast. Took a jump right into the side of a cement bridge. Dad took a head plant into the cement bridge and was a full cardiac arrest. Tom took a chest plant into the speedometer, then hit the bread and cement embankment and landed in the snowbank. Okay. We were called down to try to resuscitate the dad. So it's an hour helicopter flight. Okay. So that's what we went to do. So we get down there and we worked on this dad, and we couldn't obviously resuscitate him, and we pronounced him dead at the scene. So my paramedic and I, we picked up all of our equipment and we're starting back to the helicopter. And I looked over, and there was sitting Tom in the snowbank. He'd been ignored by absolutely everybody. They were so concerned about the dad that was in full cardiac arrest. They never looked at 10-year-old Tom. He was super quiet. Now, what 10-year-old do you know of that's super quiet? He was super quiet, holding absolutely completely still, did not move a muscle. He was very pale, pasty in color, and he looked awful. Oh my gosh. So we immediately started looking at Tom. Tom had the most perfect imprint of a speedometer, including the speed numbers, totally imprinted on his chest. His sternum was crushed and he had no breath sounds. So I knew he'd collapsed lungs and he needed chest tubes, right? But he looked terrible. So I looked at my paramedic and said, let's swoop and scoop. Let's load him and go. We'll do everything in the helicopter. I'll put all the chest tubes in the helicopter. Let's just go. That's what we did. We threw him in the helicopter and we took off for Primary Children's. So it's an hour flight. I called up Primary Children's, told the trauma team, activated them, told them what we had, what was going on. And then I laid out all my scalpels and instruments and chest tubes ready to start cutting this kid's chest open to get chest tubes in. Okay. Okay. Remember in the helicopter, we wear headsets, right? With the microphone. Okay. As I picked up that scalpel, found my landmark, and went to slice this kid's chest, I heard in my headset, don't put that chest tube in. I looked at my paramedic and went, why not? And he looked at me so confused and said, I didn't say anything. So I asked my pilot, hey, Big John, why? Why should I not put the chest tubes in? He looked around the central pillar and said, I didn't say anything. I said, oh, okay. So I thought, well, this is strange. So I picked up the scalpel, found my landmark, and went to slice his kid's chest open again. Now in my head said, I'm hearing screaming, don't put the chest tube in. Okay, I got it. A little slow on the uptake, but I got it. Okay, so I looked at my paramedic. He's busy putting IVs in this kid, not paying attention to me at all. So I very calmly said to my paramedic that I changed my mind. I'm a woman, I can do that, right? I changed my mind. I'm not going to put a chest tube in. Tom's stable. He has good vital signs. He's saturated good. I'm not going to do it. My paramedic looked at me like, have you lost your ever-living mind? My pilot looks around the center pillar and looked at me like, what? I said, it's okay. He's stable. Let's not rock the boat. Just get me to Primary Children's. So we got to Primary Children's and I absolutely got yelled at by the trauma surgeon. I was called every incompetent, terrible, demeaning, subservient name you could ever imagine in your vocabulary. It was awful. So the surgeon ran Tom to surgery, cut, put that chest tube in, right? And Tom bled out on the table and cardiac arrested. They worked on that kid and worked on that kid, and it took them an hour and they finally resuscitated Tom. Units and units and units and units and units of blood. We don't carry that kind of blood in the helicopter, do we? Now, Tom did okay. I mean, he pulled through, and I talked to him a lot since then. But about 4 hours later, I had a very humble trauma surgeon call me and apologized for treating me so evil. He told me what he had done, and he says, I know you made the right decision not to put that chest tube in. Had I done that chest tube in that flight, that child would have died on me, and we would not have been able to resuscitate him. Again, I had divine intervention. It's amazing. So let's quickly talk about some after effects that you might hear of, or your loved one might have, or you just don't know what to make sense of. The first thing is that experiencers will come back. I don't care if they're kids or adults. It's all the same. They think they've lost their minds. They've gone insane. I know I did. Okay. So understand that this is a big fear that they'll think you will think that they're insane. Okay. So just keep that in mind. Now, survivors come to love and accept everybody. Jealousy can really creep in here. Okay. Jealousy. Especially when they're hugging and loving on everybody. Okay. So be careful of that. Experiencers have a hard time with boundaries. There's no really boundaries up in, you know, the other dimensions. So they become this real childlike naivety. There's just no boundaries. I don't know what to do with them. The other thing that goes with this is they have a hard time with time. They stop wearing watches. I had a beautiful girlfriend who had a very extensive NDE, and she was constantly 2 to 3 hours late, no matter what. And she would say, oh, am I late? What do you think? Okay, she just could not get time boundaries. She just did it no longer computed. Okay, some people come back with expanded sensitivities. They're clairvoyant, they're ESP, they have intuitiveness, dream awareness, you name your thing. There's so many of them, but they usually have an enhanced sensitivities. All right. They have difficulty with communication and relationships. They don't know how to communicate because our English language just doesn't have the words to describe our experience. So be patient with these people. They're struggling on how to tell you what they've been through. Okay. Men become more thoughtful, caring, emotionally expressive. Women can become more assertive and outspoken. Can you imagine the spouse trying to wonder what the heck has gone on to my, who are these people? Who am I married to? Okay. So it becomes a real problem. There is a 75% divorce rate among experiencers because of some of these things. They just don't get along anymore. They just don't know what to do with it. And there's a really, really high divorce rate. So we have to be really aware of this. Most NDEers will never fear death again, ever. They've been there, done that. Wearing the t-shirt. Most people have a newfound hunger for knowledge and learning. That's been my problem. I'm a voracious reader all of a sudden. I just want to know everything about everything. I drive people insane with that. Bottom line is the price of having a near-death experience is truly really extremely high. There's long-term depression. There's broken relationships. There's disrupted careers. There's feelings of alienation. There's inability to function in this world because you have one foot here and one foot here, and you don't know how to rectify the two. Long years of struggling with a keen sense of like altered realities. And most NDEers have ongoing, relentless health issues. It's horrible. Okay. So how can you let's skip that. I want to get to this last part and then we'll have time for questions. So I'm going to skip this next part. But I had a very dear friend called Don Woods. He had 4 NDEs. He knew the questions to ask every NDE and he came back with more. And he put together this list, and I've had it with me because it's the most succinct, beautiful list ever. It's called The Lessons of Life. So number one, there is a God. He is a real person and he loves you very, very much. Two, you will receive a body. You may like it. You may hate it. You may loathe it. Nevertheless, it's yours. It's yours for the entire period called mortality. So take good care of it. God loves everyone. Let me repeat that. God loves everyone. Doesn't matter what race, gender, life, occupation, yearly salary, religion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He loves everybody. Four, you will learn lessons. You're enrolled in a full-time school called life. Each day in the school, you will have an opportunity to learn lessons. You may like the lessons or you may hate the lessons. Nevertheless, you're going to experience them. You chose them before you came to Earth. They are your chosen lessons. Five, there are no failures, only lessons. A lesson will be presented to you in various forms until you've learned it. When you've learned it and mastered it, you get to go on to the next lesson. Six, a lesson's going to be repeated until you learn it and master it. So you better get on the stick. It's going to be presented to you in various forms until you've learned it. And then you can go on to the next lesson. Number seven, lessons never end. It's part of life. And you remember, you chose them. There is no win. Let's see, there or when is no better or worse than the here and now. Try to live in the here and now, because there and when is going to shortly become your here and now. So just learn to live in the here and now. Nine, this is a big one for me. Others are merely a mirror of you. You cannot love or hate something about another person because it reflects something that you love or hate about yourself. They are your mirror. 10, what you make of your life is entirely up to you. You have all the tools, all the resources that you need. What you do with them is up to you. The choice is yours, all yours. 11, all your answers lie within you. 12, there are no accidents. You are accountable and responsible for everything that you choose, whether good or bad. You may be tempted to assign your responsibility to somebody else or something else. But in truth, accountability is yours. And the last one, number 13, you're going to forget all of this. So I want to thank you both here and in Zoom world for allowing me to come and talk with you tonight. It's been a long time. Florida was beautiful and wonderful. It's been fun telling you about some of the many, many, many miraculous and divine interventions I've had helping me take care of my patients. I am still working full time at St. Mark's as a hospitalist. They are still happening and I'm grateful for them. Any questions?
Some instructions here for the questions. If you are with us by Zoom, ask a question in the chat room and we will repeat it because we can't turn on everyone's microphone. It would be chaos. If you have a question here, Janet will repeat it into the microphone so the people listening by Zoom can hear it. And for everyone who asks a question, please ask a question succinctly for Janet. Don't share your own stuff. However much we may love it, want to hear it someday, tonight we're here to listen to the sage advice and wisdom of Janet.
And I only left 5 minutes, so I apologize.
Let's go over at least five.
Okay. All right. Who had that question? Go for it.
Have you talked with other nurses and doctors and medical professionals who also say that they know or feel that they have a guardian angel who has guided them and assisted them in crisis situations?
So the question is, have I talked to other medical professionals who have relayed that they also have a guardian angel helping them through all of these different things? And the answer is yes, I have. And yes, they do. I've talked to two specifically that actually know and has seen their guardian angel helping them through the resuscitation and care for their patients. Oh, the life's lessons?
Yeah.
God loves everyone. Okay.
Online, someone asked, what was number 13 of the last one?
Number 13 of the life's lessons are, you will forget everything. back here.
It's possible with us to get top of that. Share with us.
Is it the life's lessons from Don Woods?
Yeah.
I will send it to the board, and yes, they can post it onto the website. Yes. So you'll get a copy of the life's lessons by Don Woods. Okay. Yeah.
Another question. Since the people who have crossed over, you know, say it's peaceful and beautiful and they feel love and light, no more pain, why do you try to bring them back?
So knowing what I know, people go to the other side and they feel all these gorgeous, wonderful feelings. Why on earth do I bring them back? It's my job. So here's what I've also learned. If they're meant to come back, I will resuscitate you. If you choose not to come back and you're not meant to come back, there is nothing I can do that will bring you back and resuscitate you. It will be a done deal. And it doesn't matter how long I go for it. You know, I've done codes for 3 hours. Okay, it's not going to happen. Yeah.
Don't we try to have a time frame where we can come and leave? And if our mission is met, we come back and it's accepted then.
So the question is, do we have a set time frame that we're here on this earth? A start and an end, right? So I would used to tell you yes, but then I have my own case where when I got to the other side, I was told that my mission was completed. I had done everything that I had contracted with God to do, but he had another mission for me if I chose to do it. So the answer is not so fast. There can be extenuating circumstances. Okay. Oh. Yes, you.
Your experience, have you ever heard of a person having a certain amount of exit points, like 5 different times that you could have?
I haven't personally heard of that, no. So her question was, have I heard of anybody or talked to anybody that knew they had X amount of exit points that they could choose to leave this life? And no, I haven't. Now, it doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but I have not been privy to that. Yes. How many near-death experiences have I handled? Hundreds. You gotta understand, I'm old and moldy. I'm a white-haired woman now, okay? I was white after the age of 30. But I've always been in critical care and I have taken care of hundreds of patients and I'm ballsy enough to ask those patients if they go anywhere. And I hear a lot of really unique things. You have to be courageous enough to ask. Yes.
Isn't it common for those experiencers who are given a choice to regret coming back or feel guilty over that?
Yes. So the question is, do some of the people that choose to come back from their near-death experience then experience guilt or regret for their decisions? Yes. I have heard some regret about it. In my own personal case, there have been many times that I have thought to myself, what was I thinking? But yes, I've heard that, yes. Unfortunately, you're back and there's not much you can do about it. Back here in the back. So the question is, have I had divine help and intervention to help a person's passing to be more peaceful and calm? Most definitely. The key is listening and feeling. And yes, I've been able to help people pass peacefully and calmly and help their families get through it as well. Hope that answered your question.
There's okay. An online question, which is, does the life review help people to learn how to love others, which was the essence of the original question?
Does the life review help you learn to love others? Oh, I'd have to say most definitely. Because even though I didn't have a life review, what I've heard from my patients, children or adults, is that when you have your life review, you're witnessing your own life from birth to death, and you feel and see, excuse me, every feeling, you know, the whys something happened, the feelings it's happening, everything that you have felt as you're going through your life review, good, bad, or ugly, you know, it's all the same. But then you also get to feel and see the other person, what they're feeling, what they're seeing, why are they doing what they're doing? Like some people who have seen their dads or mothers abusing them, understand where their parents are coming from and why they're doing that. And they have a whole new understanding of why, and they learn to love them, which is why they learn to love everybody, because they understand it from God's perspective, and they understand why, and they understand how their actions and words cause other people to feel what they're feeling because of it. So the comment was that that we need to educate others, be it medical or not, psychologists or not, how to talk to people that have had experiences, how to interact with them, how to talk with them. And the answer is there have been several books written already, yes, about this. And there are several videos. If you go onto the IONS website, you will be able to find a lot of these videos and books that have already been written on how to communicate, how to create that safe environment that you can get these people to talk, how to get them to express what they've gone through. And so that's already been done. You just need to go get it. IONS, IANDS.
How did you get to IONS? Is it IONS.com?
IANDS.org.
.org.
Yeah.
IANDS.org.
Yeah. Well, there.
It's an international. It's an international association.
Yeah. Or if you make an inquiry at Utah IONS, we'll direct you to where it goes. One of the better books and the early ones on medical treatment is by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. If you get any of her stuff, it's fabulous.
I think we're done.
So Janet, there's one more question.
Okay.
Is the medical community becoming more accepting of the near-death experiences?
So the question is the medical community becoming more accepting of near-death experiences? And I would have to answer yes. There's still a lot of skepticism out there, but I think from when I started my career to now, it's becoming a lot more talked about and a lot more accepted. Yes. One more.
Are you afraid to die?
Am I afraid to die? Absolutely not. See, wearing the t-shirt. Been there, done that. Not at all.
Thanks for being you.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
Our thanks to Janet for coming. And for those who are here in person and by Zoom, thank you for joining us. And please tell others who might benefit from our meetings. I'm Martin Tanner, Chair of Utah IONS. Thank you for joining us tonight.